Live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, you are listening to Understanding Autism. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac alongside Kimberly Isaac and Paul Alden all the way from Houston, where I understand it was like a cool 68 to 70 coming here, and it's in the 90s. Oh, man, you just picked the wrong time.
Well, it's summer. I mean,
it feels like summer. It's not quite summer.
It will be.
I don't mind it too much, actually.
Oh, you don't mind it?
Not really. I just came from Denver. I love it, actually. It was snowing.
It was?
Yeah.
Oh, I like Denver.
Denver's nice. I'm just glad to be back in the Valley of the Sun.
And welcome to the Weather Channel. Okay. Anyway, this month is special, isn't it?
It is. It's very special.
What is this month?
Well, April is Autism Awareness Month. And actually, April 2nd was World Autism Awareness Day. And so today's show, let me just introduce myself for those of you listening for the first time. My name is Kim Isaac, and I'm a co-host of this show. I'm a RDI consultant and an autism specialist, and I'm part of this show where our focus is understanding autism.
And I'm Paul Loudon. I'm a 31-year-old who was diagnosed with Asperger's back when it was a separate diagnosis at the age of 23. And I talk about my life experiences living and growing up with autism and what insights I'm able to gain from that.
And so so we're excited about the show today because we wanted to talk today about autism around the world. And we've actually never done a show like this before, so I'm really excited about it. But in recent news, the CDC just released some new information, some new numbers about autism in the United States. And that is that one in every 68 have autism, which is 30% up from the year 2012. So when I saw that, of course, I was really inspired to look. I have to see what other countries are doing. Paul, did you have a chance to look at anything?
I looked up some things.
What did you find?
Well, mostly what I found is that what we know about autism in other countries is typically based on how they diagnose autism, and then we go through their diagnoses and retest them under our diagnosis standards. So as far as I could come across, most of the time, anytime we would examine it, we would necessarily find either an equal or lower number than they did, because all of our evaluations was weeding out false positives but never looking for false negatives. And so, it's sort of one of those things where it looks like we really don't know very much about autism around the world in terms of what realistic rates would be. There are definitely some cultural norms that really factor into the diagnosis rates. For example, I read that in Korea, a lot of times autism is considered as a genetic condition, and that it reflects then on the whole family because their genes contain autism, and so it can make it difficult to find someone to marry or have other situations. And so a lot of times Korean families actively try to cover up autism. They'll seek diagnoses for conditions that are worse or maybe reflect poorly on the mother or some other member of the family but don't reflect on the whole family because they aren't considered genetic. And so depending on your country that you're talking about, I read that this was a story by a woman, and she was of, I think, Polynesian heritage, and her husband was of Arabic heritage. And the Arabic side of the family, they saw autism as being a negative thing, that that it might be influenced from supernatural causes, from demons or spirits, and that having an autistic child reflected poorly on the family. The Polynesian side, on the other hand, they saw it as, every child is a blessing, and a child with autism is still a blessing for the family to come around together and pull the family closer as they work together to raise the child. And so these are two different cultures overlapping and having very different views on what to do with it. And again, you can see that those views would also positively or negatively affect diagnosis, as the culture says, we don't want to see these children, and the culture says we do want to see these children. So diagnosis in countries is very much a product of cultural expectations and what the country sees. And that's before you even go into clinical diagnosis, because clinical diagnosis, as we've talked about on here often, is the symptoms.
So let me ask you this then. Is there any element of bias in America? For example, if a school system tied in their budget to having certain diagnosis of certain things to fill the school, could that somehow, consciously, unconsciously, affect their diagnosis?
Well, unconscious bias is a huge thing in every aspect of the world. I mean, don't get me started on unconscious bias, because this is something that, you know, I drives me crazy when I see people talking about certain things, and it's clear that, you know, they don't know what a double-blind study is. And it's like, seriously, just because you think you can spot a difference doesn't mean that there's a difference there. You really need to be involved in a properly set up double-blind study to have any chance of doing it. You need good sample sizes. People don't understand anything about statistics, and it drives me crazy. But we do know that in the U.S., typically, you see higher rates of autism diagnoses in areas where autism awareness is higher, that it's more diagnosed in places where there's good autism services. Now, part of that is that as people, you know, if you know someone with autism, then you have a little bit of a better idea for spotting the signs of it. Or if you are associated with someone who's professionally involved in autism, they might spot the signs in it in your child. We know that these areas typically have better services for people with autism. So part of it may be just more people clustering there who have autism in the family. We don't know all the causes, but we do know that the better the autism services are, the higher the rate of autism in the area. And there's probably many causes for that, but we don't know what they all are yet. But we also know that within different cultures in America that we see different rates of autism diagnosis. We know that autism is typically diagnosed lower in African American cultural groups, I think Hispanic cultural groups, and part of that might be cultural, that they are less likely to spot it because often there are other stresses on the family, there are other expectations of the children. Part of it, again, is that autism is spotted by symptoms, and different cultures may mask or affect how those symptoms present in very different ways. So we do know that right now, autism diagnosis and autism spotting is a huge mishmash based on, you know, how educated the person who's looking for autism is, what kind of culture the person who might have it is, what the services are like in the area, that everything factors into whether the right people are going to get the right diagnosis. And that's why autism awareness and knowing, genuinely knowing about autism, what it looks like, what it means, is so important, because we've seen that the one factor that dramatically improves autism diagnosis is knowledge about autism.
That makes this show very important.
Definitely. You know, it's interesting when you said the Hispanic. I actually found some similar things too, but I just want to point out, I'm sorry, when you talked about South Korea, is they actually, when I was reading into it a little bit more, they actually do encourage to diagnose reactive attachment disorder.
Yeah, that was, and I couldn't remember the name of it, but
yeah,
that's what I was referring to.
But what's interesting about that is, for people who don't know what that is, it basically is a result of saying children form healthy bonds with their parents due to abuse, neglect, or being orphaned. And so what that does in South Korea is it puts the blame on the mother, so that it's the mother wasn't taking care of the child right, therefore this child has reactive attachment disorder, so it doesn't bring shame to the family or to the head father of the family and stuff like that. I thought that was really, really interesting. But it also reminded me of the importance of how you think and what you believe and how it determines how you will treat another person, you know, the kind of language that you'll use and stuff like that. The problem with any misdiagnosis, and especially intentional misdiagnosis, is that that one, you know, implies that counseling can fix that, or, you know, intensive counseling. So I just thought that was interesting. And then on the in the Hispanic culture, I was thinking that because autism is more prevalent in the men, a lot of times the men are sort of kind of have more solitude. They may not, they're kind of more serious, maybe not so social. You know, just I think that it's the men are seen a little bit differently in that culture. So maybe because there's so many, you know, boys that are diagnosed, that maybe they might see a boy who's a little more serious or, you know, playing by himself, and they're not going to try to socialize and pinch him and do all these, you know, mushy things with him due to the culture. But I guess the point is, too, is what's interesting is each culture really does have a set of behaviors that they find acceptable or unacceptable, and that ties into, you know, diagnostics. So actually, why don't we take a short break, and when we come back, we can talk more about autism around the world.
Okay, and there I am. I thought Anyway, this is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, and we'll be right back.
Birenbaum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday of the month from 3 to 4. I'm Dave Isaac alongside Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. It is Autism Awareness Month. This is great. Perfect timing. How did we arrange that, Kim? Oh, because
they're well, we didn't.
You're right. But this is really important. You know, I don't know if it's about the show, but I do like what both of you were saying as we went into the break and on the break about how there's, you know, different cultures. Maybe there should be different testing, perhaps, and different ways of looking at things. And we were Paul and I were talking about IQ tests, for example, that it has a certain bias if there's a certain cultural experience that other groups can't relate to.
And I talked about how one thing that, you know, one way I talk about autism is that it affects how you absorb culture, that a child with autism is typically a slightly to moderately to extremely difficult culture from the people around him, that he's picked up different signs, he's picked up different things. The problem with a lot of the way we diagnose cultures, we talk about things like, does the child make eye contact? Does the child socialize with friends at an expected rate? And, you know, there's those expectations. And then, you know, if you're diagnosing autism, you really need to take into account, you know, like, with the behaviors of the culture that the child is raised in. Is the child raised in a social environment? Is the child kept more isolated than, in other words? Because you're comparing the child's development to typical development for their culture. And a lot of times, you know, especially, you know, when we are thinking, we might compare the child's development to what we consider typical development. But there's also the case of, like, you know, we often talk about, you know, how far behind is the child? Is the child, you know, this far behind the curve, this far behind the curve? But when you look at, you know, development, how far behind is off might depend on the rate at what development is expected normally to be. That something that we might consider, you know, 2 years behind might only be, you know, half a year behind what their normal development is within their culture. So it's very hard to talk about, like, how do you diagnose it in other cultures without really going into, like, what are the cultural expectations there and what does it look like when someone misses them?
And that's critical. Also, boundary issues in different cultures. Some people get really close, acceptable space between two people when they're conversing, and which I think is really interesting in itself. And again, it's a cultural difference.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if we saw a child not acknowledging personal space here in the States, we'd say there's something going on there.
Yeah.
But if we saw a child not mattering with culture, but if we saw a child keeping a distance in, say, maybe an Arabic or a Southeast Asian culture, we might say, hey, there's something wrong here. Why is he, you know, why does he need so much personal space? What's going on? And so a lot of these things are signs that require a lot of interpretation, because as we get further from Western culture, where we know a lot about what autism looks like, we don't know how to interpret whether the sign is related to autism or something else.
And same thing with eye contact, too. Like, and honestly, this also ties into us using the most accurate language for how we are defining autism. Because really, the lack of eye contact is representative of something else. But the actual physical act of not having eye contact, in some cultures, it's rude if you're looking someone in the eyes for a certain amount of time or whatnot. But
oh,
really,
yeah. Direct eye contact can seem defiant in a lot of cultures.
Right, or just disrespectful or intimidating, like the looking. But the real issue is it's not, I mean, you see that there's lack of eye contact, but the issue behind it is that person's not necessarily absorbing what they're supposed to absorb through studying. And in some cultures, even though they're not supposed to be maybe staring and studying, like peripheral studying should be going on developmentally. So sometimes the wordage can be, you know, a little bit tricky. But something that listeners may want to know is the standard of evaluation for mental health disorders, there is sort of a worldwide measure that's respected, not necessarily by all countries, but quite a few. And it's the thing that we adhere to here in the States. It's called the DSM. And that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders. And basically, it's updated every 10 or so years. And as it is becoming more updated, the numbers of the instances of reported autism is changing. And it's funny, when I see sometimes I look at the graph, and, you know, in the 70s it was like 1 in 10,000 people, and it just kind of changes every decade. And I realize, well, it correlates with the change in the new DSM is coming out. And so then what they do is a bunch of psychiatrists, they come together and they form a board, and they all look at the research and they decide. And again, it's not just in the Americans, it's people from around the world. And they update the diagnostic criteria based on what they're all finding. So generally that's used as an acceptable standard. Now, for some of the Eastern cultures, because the DSM seems to have more Western culture and values in it, sometimes they look at the DSM and sort of dismiss it because they're saying, well, that's just Western stuff. The thing is Eastern culture, they may not want to be as involved in research because then you'd have to admit you have autism. So maybe in South Korea, they don't want to necessarily participate. And sometimes that causes trouble when they are trying to get more accurate you know, instances of autism in some areas is not everybody wants to disclose their information. And so that can affect and skew, you know, some of the numbers as well.
So what have either one of you researched or read about how different countries place their priorities on allocation? And it appears we had a little technical difficulties, but we were talking about, Kim, different countries.
Allocate resources.
Yeah, and if they do it, you know, I mean, everyone has different priorities, right?
Well, I think it really depends on which countries are, like, culturally more open to autism and talking about it. You know, when I was online looking for numbers and things, it seemed like, you know, places like Canada, Australia, the UK were much easier to find more information on. And actually, I'll just share the numbers that I found just to give them to people. But in Australia, 1 in 62. In Canada, 1 in 200. And the UK, more than 1 in 100, which is how they phrased it, which I thought was interesting. You have to remember that the numbers represent regions, and again, that depends on if people are disclosing, you know. So I guess it's the most accurate someone can get with the region that they're studying and the resources that they have. But those countries had quite a bit of information online. Australia, you know, has an advocacy group, Autism Society of Canada. You know, so those were things that came up quite easily online. And I actually know some different professionals in those countries where they're very actively, the government is actually actively involved in autism, and there's a lot of, actually some, you know, grants and things. I think some of these countries are getting a little bit more than we are from the government. So, yeah, I don't know the exact numbers on that. But I am excited to know that people are learning more. These countries that we're talking about, they are understanding autism a little bit differently, and they are putting forth, you know, efforts to develop support groups and put on conferences, stuff like that.
That's interesting, though. I suspect then, unfortunately, if you're in a country that just hasn't paid attention or has all sorts of other trouble and they have to allocate their resources differently, then there's probably a lot of groups left out in the cold, which is really
probably not just autism, but for an issue like that. But I guess so. There's the factor of actually the culture and what's acceptable. Because, like, sometimes mental. Well, here's the thing: is some countries still view autism as mental illness? Because back in the day, you know, when Leo Kanner first talking about autism, the term autism was used in reference to symptoms for other mental illnesses, like schizophrenia. Yeah. So it was used for other things to describe, because it comes from the Greek word autos, which is self, so withdrawing yourself, you know, that sort of thing. And so it was used a lot in schizophrenia. So sometimes it's the evolution of countries keeping up with all the research and realizing, okay, maybe they had heard the term autism back then as it refers to, you know, schizophrenia, and they haven't caught up from that. But then some countries look down on mental illness pretty significantly, where I know some families from India that's a really big struggle for them, that they can't really take their kids out in public sometimes, because it's just so, I mean, kids that have some pretty obvious behaviors and things, that it stands out so much that it's not really safe for them to be out like that. So it just kind of depends on how you are viewing autism as a country, and if you're up to date on the research, and if your culture, you know, somehow coincides with it too. But it looks like it is time for another break. So when we come back, we will continue our discussion, Autism Around the World. If you have any questions or comments, you can post them on our Facebook page. I have Facebook up right now, and we'd be happy to hear your feedback. And we'll be right back.
Beerenbaum and Speen PC,
We want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary.
Ridenour, Heitzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heitzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at r.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And really focus on the understanding. And so this month there are a lot of activities in different cities. And you can go to, actually I think under World Autism Day, they have some different activities that they're listing and people are posting for the month of April. And also on the Autism Society of America, they have some things listed as well. But basically, yeah, just a lot of people are having events. I saw some people who are having movie nights where you bring your kids with autism to the movies, and there's some picnics and stuff going on. On our Facebook page, I've been trying to post some tidbits more on the understanding side just to help people, to give them a little bit more than, hey, there's this thing called autism, but helping them understand a little bit differently, you know, what that might mean.
And when did that start? I mean, Autism Awareness Month. Has this been more recent as awareness became more common? Or,
I want to say
what?
This is the ninth one.
Yeah, I want to say, I feel like it's, yeah, I mean, it's not super new, but it's definitely in the last decade that it started, and more people are participating, which I think is great, and I know that in itself is a step towards, you know, networking with the right people. Some people are really interested in understanding. Some people are just interested in sort of standing on the sidelines. But there's always something that you can do to understand or support a family or a person on the spectrum.
Always. There's no doubt about it. And you can never give enough, can you?
Well, my personal philosophy is, no. I mean, I'm a giver, so I'm all about that. But everybody's different. But actually, a simple way, I'm going to post this on our Facebook, Amazon.com, it actually has this special program. It's called the Smile Program right now, and you can choose which charity that you want to donate to. And the American Autism Society of America is actually one of the options. And I really appreciate them. They're really a non-biased organization that's just supportive of the individual. You know, they don't push any particular therapy. They're just, you know, a wealth of knowledge and resources. And so there's this particular link that you have to click that I'll post on our Facebook page. So if I'm an Amazon shopper, so I've already been able to support and do my regular shopping.
So you have your free two-day shipping.
Well, it's not, I mean, pay for the membership. But anyway,
I did that.
You did that too?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to send you the link too. But anyway, so you choose your charity. Autism Society of America is one of them, and it donates a percentage to that organization.
That's excellent. No doubt about it. So what other activities or what other things go along with Autism Awareness Month?
Well, that I can't really speak to. For me personally, I've just been involved again with helping spread the understanding. Today, Paul and I are just really talking about thinking about autism around the world, and we kind of really focus on more of that cultural perspective. I'm not really sure what people in other countries actually did on World Autism Awareness Day. That's a good question. I'll have to investigate that. But I'm guessing it's probably pretty similar. You know, like here we also have the Lighted Up Blue Day where, you know, people wear blue to show their respect and acknowledgement of autism and support. And so I don't know what other countries.
Now, where is Paul wearing blue?
I know.
I brought a blue shirt with me, and when I put it on, I discovered it had shrunk.
No, but there's some other place.
No, but, so, but I do have blue in my hair for the
moment. Yes.
Yes, I did see that.
It's very cool, it's very too. I like it a lot.
I want to get a picture of that. I was actually going to go to Sally's and get a blue extension, but I've been quite busy.
Really?
I haven't had a chance, but I am wearing a shirt that has plenty of blue.
I have blue jeans
in it.
Does that count?
Sure. but before the break, so we were talking about, you know, autism, and we were talking about the DSM and how, again, it's kind of a guidebook that our country and many countries except as a guideline for diagnosing things, and also how some countries may be a little bit behind in terms of their version of understanding the current research and how things have evolved, you know, from the 70s when autism was really, you know, more publicized and brought up. So another thought that I had, I don't know, Paul, what you think about this, but, I mean, you've spent time overseas and you visited a lot of different countries. I mean, I guess I was thinking, too, the concept of, I guess, kind of survival mode versus self-expression mode, if that plays into how people, I mean, people may not think there's problems based on their culture where, you know, maybe being so social, you know, autism is referred to as a lot of social disorder, communication disorder, but, I mean, some cultures aren't very social like that, right? They're very kind of solitary and...
Well, it does... vary so much from culture to culture. I mean, you still, in the world today, have, you know, African villages where the children are raised as a group versus, you know, our modern countries where, you know, you very much have the nuclear family and everything like that. But there's so much variety. You know, I've mentioned this before. Japan has the saying, the nail that sticks out is struck down. And that illustrates that they are very much a culture of not showing your individuality, that they very much expect everyone to sort of behave the same way, look very similar. And I can very easily see where autism might not be spotted until much later in that culture because you're hiding a lot of the expressiveness that autism is about spotting the lack of. And so once, you know, you might get later diagnoses and you might have more challenges. I know that I've read that a lot of cases where you do have cultures that make it harder to spot autism, that it doesn't get spotted until later, and then you have a lot more challenge in helping because, as we know, earlier intervention is one of the biggest. I can definitely see in some Asian cultures you might encounter situations like that. But it is going to vary so much. I mean, you know, one thing that people with autism are often known for is credulity, that they'll often sort of believe things that you tell them, whether or not there's reason to believe it. So you might have cultures where, you know, the culture is taught rather than observed, you know, because you have a lot of cultures where culture is observed. American culture sort of seems to be one of those, where you pick up that you're supposed to care about your local football team or things like that. But you also have cultures, and a lot of these are sort of more religious cultures, where the culture is taught, that you're taught by a religious scholar this is what you do to respect your family, this is what you do. And so when those cultures are very structured, very you know, methodical about how the culture is transmitted on, I think that in those it's going to be a lot harder to spot the person who's autistic because they are taught a series of behaviors. It's not quite at the level of ABA where we notice lacking behaviors and create systems, but they are taught, you do this when this happens, you do this when this happens. When someone says this, you respond with this, that it's very much like a treatment for, you know, a very simple treatment, a very not necessarily effective, but enough of one that autistic children will probably learn these things and cover up the more severe symptoms until they need a lot more help. Maybe they regress at a later age and stop being verbal, or maybe something else happens. Maybe they don't regress and that they, you know, suffer as someone with Asperger's does, where they've got depression and anxiety and they're getting by and they feel that they don't belong in this culture, but they still have learned the lessons. So depending on your culture, I can very easily see a cultural cover-up to autism happening, not intentionally, and not because the culture doesn't believe in autism, but just because of how children are raised, how children are educated, that the signs of autism are going to show up later or aren't going to show up as what we familiarly recognize as autism. They may just be diagnosed with depression, and we never recognize that underneath that depression, the cause for it is autism. And so, you know, they spend the next 30 years of their life trying different medicines and trying other changes, and really the problem is something deeper down that they've never gotten a chance to address. So I can very much see culture as having a huge influence on how well we're able to spot autism.
So that's interesting when you talk about the structure making virtually everyone the same or responding the same to certain contexts. And we've talked about that long and hard throughout the years on the show, where that's one of the areas where, you know, you just can't have one package response because there has to be some flexibility, right?
Yes.
And some type of idea to appropriately apply in different contexts. So Paul, you were saying if everyone sort of,
similar.
Yeah, similar to respond always to this in this context, and that you can't tell who might be on the spectrum, who may not be. That's
one
a real good point.
We have here is, in America, we have a pretty strong push for individuality. It's not as strong as it may have been in the past, and there are a lot of forces pushing against it. But we still have this message of you can do what you want, you can be what you want, and we expect our kids to go out and play and imagine and do things. If you have a culture where, you know, say it's sort of, again, we go back to maybe the African village or the village in India or the Chinese town, where when your child comes home from school or whatever, he then goes to help you plant the fields or to care for the goats or something, that these are, again, very structured behaviors. And so the less room that you have for play in your culture, the less room that you have for imagination in your culture, the harder it is going to be to spot autism early, I think.
Definitely. No, I definitely agree, because when you look at some of the symptoms that, you know, in the diagnosis, it's like imaginative play, you know, the eye contact and stuff. And if a country's not, doesn't value or encourage that kind of expression, then, it wouldn't matter to you. I mean, they're doing fine in your eyes, you know. And in that culture, then, you know, I mean, that's how they fit. And
so there's probably a lot of room in terms of unifying globally.
And that's one thing is that, you know, we're still looking and learning about the underlying causes of autism. We're learning, you know, what you can spot on an fMRI, and you can learn about what causes the behaviors, because we diagnose by behaviors, but there's something inside. And so, you know, one thing about disorders like this is that, you know, we judge them as disorders because they prevent someone from living a normal life. These children who grow up in this hypothetical country where, you know, they've learned all the rules and they are sort of having a normal life, but they may still be suffering. And if changes happen, maybe they're 35 and suddenly, you know, they hit a bad streak and they lose their house. And then from that day on, they're not able to recover. That, you know, that there is value, even when it's not impacting them now, in spotting autism before it does impact them, that even if they've developed coping habits, even if they've developed skills that allow them to exist in their culture, the better we are at spotting autism and the better we are at removing the stigma of autism so people can admit to it, people can share information about it, the better we're going to be able to prepare people for those moments when it does become a problem.
I agree with that. And maybe why don't we take our final break, and when we come back, I thought we could talk a little bit about giving some understanding autism pieces of information and really focusing on that piece. So let's take a short break. When we come back, we will be discussing autism around the world in terms of understanding.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Alden. This is Autism Awareness Month. We've been talking a lot today, cultural differences, very important, unifying maybe the global world on autism. That would be very important as well. because each country, as we know, develops differently and they have different priorities. And now, Kim, the last segment.
What I thought we could talk about here at the end is really some things related to understanding. And, you know, in the spirit of we've talked about culture and how some cultures still view, and actually even here in the United States, autism, or they assume that autism is a mental illness. And so I think it's important that listeners understand that autism is actually a real physical thing. It is not a mental illness. It's neurological, biological, actual things you could see on an fMRI. A lot of times, health-related things, you can test for mitochondrial dysfunctions, things like that, and different, a lot of medical things. And actually, I do want to mention one of our guests we've had in the past, Dr. Jim Adams. He's going to be speaking at a conference in Russia where people from professionals on the eastern side of the world are going to come to actually learn about the physical side of autism. So in the spirit of talking about culture sort of, like, lack of better wording, catching up, I'm excited that, and I think listeners should know that there's things like that happening. So, but anyway, Paul, what are your thoughts on autism from the actual physical perspective?
Well, I mean, it illustrates why it's so important. Understanding is so important as opposed to just awareness, is that the casual awareness that when you try to spread, you know, we talk about it's Autism Awareness Month, you know, that at this point, 90-something percent of the U.S. population probably is familiar with the term autism and has a mental picture for it, but probably less than 5% have an accurate picture of it in terms of what it means to be autistic and not just, you know, what a loose approximation of autism is. And the problem with just autism awareness is that you're spreading a cultural view of autism, that American autism awareness is awareness of American autism. If we really work on building understanding of autism, talking about the internal effects of it, what it means to live a life with autism, what it means physically to have autism, what it means on an fMRI scan, what autism means for your quality of life and the challenges that you run into and your ability to understand things, then you can use that to build an understanding of autism in other countries, where if you go to, Norway, and you go to Norway and you try to understand autism in Norway, if you start with the American awareness of autism, if you start with our symptoms, and you start saying, well, these kids don't have these symptoms. Why are they diagnosed with autism? What am I working with here? And if you try to work back from the symptoms, it'll be very challenging, and you're working on unlearning a lot of things. But if you try to cultivate a deeper understanding of autism, then what you're seeing there is you'll look at those symptoms and go, oh, so this is how they express this internal challenge. This is how they express, you know, these difficulties, and you'll see them as expressions. And so this idea that autism looks different in other cultures and other countries is something huge to learn from, because it gives us a broader understanding of what autism looks like while still being the same thing. So as we get better about understanding the internal causes of autism, then our views of it in other cultures are going to help us diagnose it here and elsewhere better. And so it just builds a much clearer picture of autism as we see it more and more in other countries.
You know, let me ask you this, and this might be the appropriate time or not, but I was just curious. If you went on the street, and you both have been on the street, and both of you have had a focus on autism for such a long time, but if you went up to someone, almost like what Jay Leno does, and he asks a question on the street, you know, about a certain famous person and most people don't even know, but if you said, what does it mean when you hear the word autism, what's your first thought? What do you think people would say?
Like in Rain Man?
Yeah, I mean,
that's the question that
yeah,
you
that's
get
what
from,
they would say.
What
you'd
is
probably
it?
Get that from about 70% of people.
Interesting.
And then, you know, you probably would get maybe another 10% would mention Temple Grandin because they've seen the Lifetime special or whatever. Where they know that, but they know just that very narrow view of autism.
I don't think they know her name. They'd probably say
yeah,
that lady
with
the animals.
that lady with the cows.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Hey, that's an interesting. Maybe we should do something.
Well, I was
like
thinking
that.
Of that because it's Autism Awareness Month, and I bet anything.
Put it on our YouTube channel.
You're going to get a lot of blank looks too. I just bet like you'll see their eyes roll up trying to get a visual picture and they may you may hear some really crazy stuff, but
I'm sure you would. And
that's the whole point. It's like really, I mean, this is Awareness Month. Let's get it right and at least get an understanding of it. I think that might
be. Well, that's one of the big challenges on Autism Awareness Month is that news companies, you know, your CNN, your MSNBC, your Fox, whatever, they run a lot more articles about autism during Autism Awareness Month. But it's almost all articles about research. It says, so-and-so might show signs for helping to cure autism, or so-and-so allows us to spot the autism or autistic symptoms in the brains of mouse using scans, or so-and-so. And they're very interesting. And they're fantastically interesting for people whose lives are impacted by autism. For people whose lives aren't impacted by autism or who don't know their lives are impacted by autism because everyone's life is impacted by autism, given the diagnosis rates, then they're not that interesting, and they don't educate them because, you know, better lithium intake might prevent autism in infants. Sure, that's fantastic, but it doesn't help Bob, who, you know, works at the car company, notice that, you know, one of his employees might be on the spectrum, and, you know, he might be able to offer some help. So if we had news articles or articles that were educating people about autism rather than just interesting autism in news, it would be fantastic. And that's one of the big weaknesses right now with Autism Awareness Month, is that the people who can spread awareness are spreading awareness of the wrong part of autism to really help benefit those on the spectrum.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, no, I agree. But hopefully we're doing our small part here on our Facebook. We're posting some tidbits about the understanding. But it is a really good point, because the truth is that you're going to interact with someone with autism. It's pretty much a certainty in your life at some point. And, you know, it's really just about understanding so that you can, you know, support one another, communicate better, get along better. I mean, the more we understand, the more the fruits of that will develop. Is when you understand someone better, you can communicate differently and be more productive. Then when you have a lot of misunderstandings and you're, you know, because you don't know that, hey, this person is just thinking differently than me, they're not trying to be oppositional, they're not, you know, trying to start problems, they actually just think differently than me. Okay, let's work this out. Let's figure out, okay, this is how I see it. How are you seeing it so that I understand you better? That's one of the biggest tips that I like to give people as just a basic thing, is just keeping that open mind that, first of all, in life people think differently. When it comes to autism, it's pretty different, and they may appear like maybe you look at them and think we have to be on the same page because we're both in the same room, we're both looking at the same thing. But it's important to remember that what's going on in your mind may not be what's going on in the other person's mind, and it's important to ask questions and to share your thoughts and work together on it.
What about autism in the workplace? I mean, have we ever done anything like that where, as part of a management training program? Because if you think about that, it's all about communication. The greatest managers really seem to have a great understanding. And this key word, understanding, applies so many
places. I've been getting more calls for this, actually, lately.
You have.
I have. I've had people approach me with different things related to, I suspect my coworkers on the spectrum, what do I do? Or even actually a manager contact. I haven't told you that, Paul. I'm going to tell you that when I see. But contacted me and said, you know, what can I do? I don't know if this person's diagnosed. I mean, that was kind of an interesting thing is, you know, if this person is diagnosed, they never disclosed it in their job. But this manager saying, from what I've read about autism, I think one of my employees has it, and what should I do about that? And so that would be actually an excellent show.
I think there's a couple of things we came out here. Maybe
yeah.
You should do people talking about one word, first thought about autism, and then maybe talk to a few CFOs, CEOs of a select group of companies, and do they have training programs or integrated into their management styles? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. They don't.
Well, as of now, I'm safe to say it's not very common.
Oh, okay.
But I think that there's a growing interest.
And I'd argue that, you know, given that autism rates are, you know, above 1 in 100 in a lot of it looks like, I mean, current diagnosis rates are above 1 in 100, that, you know, if you're managing 50 people or more, it'd probably be good for you to know something about autism, because odds
yeah.
are pretty good one of those people is either on the spectrum or a future employee will be on the spectrum.
Time to get in touch with.
So, I mean, you know, 1 in 50, that's not that big.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. But if you're in the Fortune 500 companies and you get 10,000
people. Oh, absolutely.
People,
then you've got
I think we got
on the spectrum at least.
I got some ideas. This is great. This hour flew by. How do they get in touch with you guys, Kim, Paul?
The best way to get in contact with us is to hit our Facebook page at facebook.com/understandingautismradio. Leave us a comment there. questions you have for a show, anything like that.
Excellent. Well, this has been a great show, and I think a lot of other great shows coming up. We'll be on next Monday, won't we?
Yes.
3 to 4.
Yes. On Monday, we're going to be talking about traveling tips.
Oh, that's
traveling
excellent.
With someone with autism.
And that's going to be great. And this is Understanding Autism. Everyone have a great night. We'll see you next week.